and you'd get women getting grants to set up collective houses that were lesbian only. You'd get women getting money to start their own shelters and like lesbian drop-in centers. It was a very, very fascinating point in history. And so the ability to create spaces changed rapidly and very profoundly in the 70s and 80s, which really changed the possibility for what a lesbian or dyke bar would look like. So I've done interviews with a lot of women who were activists out and about in their like 20s and 30s in the 70s and 80s and even a little bit earlier and even later. But that's been the focus. In that, I would include a lot of like women's dances because like lesbian feminists were big on the women's dances. So they'd book halls and just have these very political but also very sexy kind of parties that were also kind of roving to, you know, even before, you know, the more contemporary experience that we have now in Vancouver, but working with kind of the economic limitations and the resources and really trying to find ways to be creative about making social space. But so much of that community was about being incredibly political in kind of everything they did, overtly political. Yeah, stories about like dropping acid and going to parties and just like dancing with a lot of people. And a lot of the collective kind of housing movement was really big at the time. So you'd have these lesbian only collective houses where everyone was sleeping with each other, working together, organizing together, fighting and fucking and like all that stuff. Oh my God, that's even part of the L word entrance. Fighting, fucking, oh God. this terrible show, but awesome. And so one really good old story that I had briefly mentioned before the interview was the Vanport, which I mentioned was very rough and tumble. And I was told a story about some of the folks that I was interviewing who were lesbian feminists who were wanted to see what the dyke bars were like. And again, there was this very interesting class experience of going to the Vanport and being terrified and being asked immediately, like, are you a butch or a femme? Are you a top or a bottom? For what it's worth, like, I'm not critiquing that. That was just a very different scene. So these, like, there's all these different nuances of lesbian, dyke, queer women. There's not a homogenous culture by any means. So going, and there was a lot of like sailors, like cis dudes, and then a lot of like butch dykes and some of their girlfriends, and you know, witnessing a fight where a sailor or a dude or whatever had tried to flirt with someone's girlfriend who was a femme, and this person like responding by smashing a chair on his back. I don't condone violence, but that is really awesome. And it's, yeah, it's funny, but it's also like this, these were spaces where it was a lot of grief, a lot of trauma. I mean, you still see in queer scenes, this, we love our bars, but it also comes from a history of trauma and having to hide and like, and often hiding in spaces, but also hiding in addiction and like drugs and alcohol and, you know, like trauma begets trauma. So it's very complicated, but that is a great story. Mm-hmm. Quite a few women would be like, telling me about their first time at a dyke bar and being like, you know, completely blown away, you know, just figuring out you're gay, which is still like, when I was 18 and I first went to a gay bar in Winnipeg, it was like, you know, just had the goofy kind of like club music and the rainbow everywhere. And I was just like, yes, yes. So that hasn't gone away, but it was much more pressing and intense when it was still illegal, right? Yeah. And in many ways, there's people all over the world who still experience that. But I had talked to a woman who's been an activist since 1970, and she's like, I've been an out dyke femme since 1970. She had like the Labrys tattoo on her arm.
What does that look like? Describe it.
It's a two-headed axe that was known for being the weapon of the Amazons. So dykes in the 70s love that. It's really cool. She had said, you kids don't know what it's like to walk down into a bar. You go down the stairs and all you smell is like smoke and sex and desire, and the walls are just, it was so hot. She was just, like, the walls are just seeping with it, and everyone's like, to resist, we just like, you know, have this really intense like sexual experience like within a bar. It's like everyone is in there together. So I thought that was a really vivid image. Stories about, you know, going into the bathroom and then like hooking up with someone in the bathroom and then like never seeing her again. And also going into a bar and then being terrified and not wanting to go back and wanting to find other places to hang out in. So, and I think the class privilege experience really changed, really informed how people experience those spaces. So those are the only stories I can think of right now.
Like, given how important and formative many of these spaces have been in the creation of community and relationships and, like, discovering identity and everything, why are these spaces that have been more geared towards women so likely to close, even to this day, when visibility is almost a given for certain communities? Mm-hmm. And there is more access to, or at least there's a perception of more access to, like, financial gain, stability, and...
Yeah, I mean, okay, we talked earlier about the shift of identity, and I think that plays a role, like the shift in identity politics, but I don't think that logistically actually is the reason or impetus behind, you know, lesbian/women's spaces being less of a thing, because I don't think identity politics can actually have the same impact as things like gentrification or neoliberalism or... sexism. Reminder, there's still sexism still exists. The queer bar culture, lesbian, gay, hasn't always been this segregation. There have been bars that were mixed, and I don't mean mixed as in the way Paige was using it, but mixed as in terms of like gay men, lesbians, trans people, all the queers, all the trans folks. So there have been moments where those bars have existed, but the ability to kind of access space is so incredibly shaped by things like privileges of gender, privileges of being white, and having access to economic resources. So, I mean, you see the space like the West End being associated with gay men. There's a pretty big contingent of West End lesbians too, but that part of the city is now so wealthy. And I mean, I recently saw a big map of Vancouver parceled off into kind of the average income, and the average income in the West End was like $90,000 or $80,000. I mean, you know what the research on that was, but in the East Side, so like downtown East Side, Hastings, Commercial Drive, a little bit less now, is more like $20,000 to $30,000. So obviously making space is going to be very contingent upon where you want to go. And the West End has this strong history of pushing out marginalized people. Like, once it became really strong as a space that where gay men, mostly white gay men, were able to build community in the 80s, there was this push to get rid of sex workers, to push them all into the downtown East Side, to as a kind of like urban renewal kind of stuff like that, which we're seeing now in East Vancouver really intensely. I know that people don't want to talk about class very much, but in my opinion, that's one of the biggest logistical issues shaping this kind of disparity between bar spaces. Yeah, like, I think that the ability for white gay and lesbian people in terms of accessing space has absolutely become... It's a lot more accessible, but the kind of the spaces that we enjoy on the East Side now don't really center, instead of centering one particular gender experience, they kind of center many intersections of oppression, which I think is a really good thing. So, I mean, what I like about Man Up is like Man Up is not, it's a woman, it can be woman centric. It's also trans centric. It also really is now really trying to aim to be a safer space for queer and trans people of color, people who are low income. So I think when at this historical moment in the 70s, when like there were no women's spaces, women were not allowed to have spaces. So there was this kind of need and desire to have spaces that was just us. And while I respect that, I think it's really great that now there's a lot more intersections that are understood in spaces.
So Nadine just mentioned that rather than in the 70s and up until, when would you say that stopped being a thing? Like after like the Riot Girl movement or?
I mean, I think we have to be careful about how much we reify this idea that nobody uses the term lesbian. I do. I also identify as queer. I also identify as a dyke. I also identify as non-binary. You do not have to pick. But I say that the kind of trendiness and the applicability of lesbian really was in decline in the early 90s.
Okay. I guess I can talk a little bit about my experience and like the history of Man Up and how it sort of has evolved and responded to these like the changing like awareness of like our generation, like in this like time and place around different intersections of identity. So I mean, of the importance of drag historically in subverting like gender norms, and you know, fighting that with this exuberant, like very queer, like sometimes silly performance art form that is like drag. And so when Man Up began, it was like kind of as a parallel to my own like understanding of gender and the queer scene at the time, was like pretty, I won't say strictly, but it was just like centered around like women and like FTM trans folks performing drag in like masculine ways, and either asserting their, you know, gender or as masculine, or exploring and just, you know, demonstrating that like I am a woman and I'm woman identified, I'm lesbian identified, whatever, and I can get on stage and be a man, and that's like my expression of drag. And over the years, I guess we began to sort of gender play, and I think that a little bit more, and there were some people in the performing group, myself included, who were starting to maybe think of masculine embodiment as so much a part of their regular lives and such a like natural thing to do that felt like aligned with like not a character we were portraying, but like our actual human selves, that we start to explore like, well, what would feminine impersonation look like? And would I call myself a drag queen, or what, you know, what would that even, some of us were still identifying as women in life, but such tomboy women that like doing like male drag was not feeling like, at least for our own selves and our own identity, like, not subversive, but not like a radical difference from like our day-to-day lives. And then I guess at the same time in the community, you know, I mean, I was kind of coming from a place of, at the time anyway, and I think it's like shifted a little bit, but coming from a place of like, I want a space where no matter like who you are, like gender identity wise, or even like orientation, like sexuality wise, you can come into the space and like gender bend and see different expressions. And so we were doing that a little bit. And then, you know, this is maybe like around like 4 years ago or something like that. And then like Rose Butch and Grimm and the Brokeback Brothers and some other folks kind of like came onto the scene and were like younger than us, and in like some ways, you know, more in tune to some of the like political ideas around like gender play, and brought this kind of like language around, I wouldn't say, I mean, didn't bring it, they brought it to me like, but of like non-binary drag, and like, you know, calling themselves a drag thing was like how, you know, how Rose kind of came onto the scene. And so that was really cool moment in our history, when it was almost like, it was like we had this question that we hadn't articulated, and these like newer younger performers like brought the answer, and then we're like, oh, that was the question, oh yeah, because like, you know, because gender is non-binary, and like, oh, this is so cool. And so then people, you know, started to do like really like glamorous masculine impersonation, and like really like, you know, sort of like edgy or messy or like, you know, feminine expression or like, some, you know, just all, sort of like all kinds of weird different things. And for me, that kind of was like the light bulb went on of like, oh, yeah, like this is what drag is or is for us anyway, or what drag like can be. And it was a way to sort of like, so I've only been talking, I know you mentioned like intersections and I've only been talking about gender so far, but I guess it was awesome to have this sort of trajectory of like how Man Up became like a broad spectrum like gender performance show, but we were still having some like issues around certain members of the community not feeling represented and like included in the space. So we were getting you know, critiques that there were not enough people of color in the show, and there were not enough fat bodies in the show, and things like that, and also a little bit earlier, like femme representation in the show, and that call up from the community was like, sort of what began the not began but or happened around the same time as like the gender sort of like broadening of what we were doing. So yeah, I guess as an organizer, the I mean it's like seems so obvious to say in hindsight, but like the greatest way to like respond to, you know, critiques about representation is to, you know, involve people of those like experiences and identities in the event, in, you know, decision making or like creative process, and putting them on stage. And like Man Up got so much better when we were including like, you know, a more like just had when it was such a more diverse cast. And so that was kind of like a gradual process. You know, I didn't want to come at it from a place of like tokenizing. It's like, okay, well now we need like a fat person in the show. It's like, but actually like it took like a couple of years of like, you know, paying attention to that a little bit better than I had in the past. And, you know, my own personal like growth as a, like a human and like my mind and understanding, you know, intersectionality and like my privilege and stuff. But like over time, we started to make like authentic connections with like people and like performance artists like in the community and fostering new people to like come up through amateur hour and stuff. And it's always of course like a work in progress, but at this point you know what people say is that it is like spectrum of like different experiences and identities in the show, which is like so important and has really shaped the space to feel more welcoming and safe for people who like share those experiences as well.
Thanks so much for listening. This was The Last Dyke Bar, a special episode of Shoes on a Wire for Pride 2018 special programming on CITR.
Hey, welcome to Chaotic Music Meetings on CITR 101.9 FM. Usually I broadcast this show from our station on Musqueam territory, but this time I am pre-recording on the traditional unceded and shared territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. What you're about to hear is a performance and interview with local punk Devours, a.k.a. Jeff Kincaid, and this was recorded as part of CITR's Day of Pride programming on August 1st. But Jeff and I both forgot about that and kept plugging a queer showcase that we're playing on July 29th. So if you're listening to this after July 29th, sorry for the confusion. We have a lot of content recorded, and I'm going to do my best to fit it into an hour, so let's get started. Cheers.
Hey, I'm Devours.
That song was called Garnet Graves, and the next one is called Freddy Krueger Honeymoon Suite.
Better time, leave you in the dark, leave you in the dark, leave you in the dark. show you how to groove the way I do. Are we grooving?
Next one is called Jason Voorhees Salon and Spa.
We got what we wanted. What are we fighting for?
next song. What am I doing? Okay, this next song is from my last album called Late Bloomer, and the song is called Jazz by Thor. Okay, you are still listening to Devours, and this is my last song. It's called Pink Hat. Thank you, Miles, for having me.
Ow. I'll be the one to love and cover you from now until the day I die. 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 Die. The day I die. The day I die.
Hello, Vancouver. This is Carolyn Mark. You're listening to CITR 101.9 on your FM dial.
CITR and Mint Records have released their biannual collab, Pop Alliance Volume 5. This glamorous record features staple Vancouver artists, Devours, Swim Team, Lord Fuckerman, Chris Horrific, and so many more. Get your copy for only $15 on iTunes or at the Mint Records store now.
This is Chaotic Music Meetings. I'm very excited because this is a pre-record. We're not doing this live from the studio. I'm actually in the home of Devours.
Hi.
AKA Jeff Kincaid. Jeff, thank you so much for inviting me here to your house. I'm sitting on the edge of your bed right now talking to you.
Yeah, very intimate. Thank you, Miles, for having me on your show. Hi, CITR. I am Jeff.
Great. Perfect. We're well on our way. Jeff just performed for me here with his live setup in his home. So I'm in Devourer's Land right now, recently treated to a stellar intimate performance.
Thank you.
Thank you. And already, like, I don't know where to start because I'm a fan of yours and I've been wanting to hang out for a while. This is really the first time that we've got to hang out one-on-one.
Yeah.
And have, like, a real conversation.
Yeah.
How's it going so far? How do you feel?
I'm great. Are you having fun?
I'm having a blast. I'm eating your blueberries. I'm drinking your juice.
Yeah. Cool.
There, you have such wholesome snacks.
Yeah.
But I feel like we should just dive into it because I have so many questions for you and I'm so interested in what you do.
Let's do it. Late bloomer.
Late bloomer.
Sorry. Yeah.
Late Bloomer is an album that you put out in 2016.
Yeah.
And that, just the image of the cover and the title, Late Bloomer, says so much immediately. What can you tell me about the title?
Yeah, the album title is a reference to my coming out as gay at a slightly older age for my generation, I guess. And it also... is a reference to me coming out as an artist in the Vancouver music and arts community, because most people here in the scene get their start younger, you know, like late teens, early 20s. And I grew up on Vancouver Island, lived in Montreal for 3 years, and then moved here in sort of like my mid to late 20s. And then it took me a handful of years to meet anyone in the music scene. And so, yeah, when I put the album out, I think I was 30, and that, I guess, is, like, a little bit old to be coming into, like, the music scene. And so, yeah, that's what the album title is.
Cool.
Referring to, yeah, it works on both of those levels.
Yeah. Actually, you saying that you lived on Vancouver Island reminded me that we went to the same high school.
We did. We just found that out.
NDSS High School, shout out.
Yep.
Yeah, I feel like we have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
I also didn't come out as queer until I was 25.
Mm-hmm.
And I really relate to the image of blooming. And you say that it's like it's related to coming out as gay and also coming out as a musician, like starting to make music for the first time.
Yeah, not so much making music for the first time. I've been making music since I was a kid, but just in terms of like creating a new identity for myself as like a public persona and as a performer, that's the major thing. Like I have worked as a background composer for certain things, I guess, like I've made some stuff for TV commercials and for documentaries and stuff like that. But in terms of actually performing, like making my own songs and performing, I just could never book shows before. Yeah, I just like couldn't meet the right people. I didn't really have the right sound for Vancouver. And it just took a long time to meet someone who would take a chance on me.
Really?
In Vancouver. Yeah. And so I think that, yeah, it's more about like performing,
right,
I suppose, and rather than like starting to make music. But
and that's a very different thing, like making music and recording music and actually performing and like getting involved in the music community in Vancouver.
Yeah,
that's a pretty huge change.
Yeah I think, yeah, like I've always basically been a bedroom musician, and then when I lived in Montreal, I think I was maybe like between the ages of 22 and 25 I was there, and I had a different project at the time, like a different stage name. I was making sort of like experimental a cappella music, and then I had a separate side project where I was basically like a one-man grunge project band or whatever. And so yeah, like my music didn't sound like what I'm doing for Devourers nowadays, but I was really like gunning for it in Montreal. I was trying to perform and trying to like be a part of the community there, and again, I just don't think that I was maybe like mature enough. I don't think that I like had cool enough clothes. I didn't really fit into the scene. I was too young. I just, yeah, it's a long story, but I did manage to perform a little bit in Montreal. I played a handful of shows here and there, but not really enough to get comfortable and build any confidence as an actual performer. And so So yeah, like years went by and I was just sort of making mixtapes in my bedroom that no one was hearing. And then yeah, with Late Bloomer, thankfully the tides turned and I started to play shows. And so yeah, that's been a big learning curve.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's just learning how to actually engage with like a crowd.
Yeah.
It's hard.
And it was cute when I got here, you seemed a little bit nervous about the setup and how we were going to record, just because you told me like you don't really know gear very well.
Yeah.
Which surprised me, because you've got a ton of gear and it's really nice and you clearly know how to use it. Like,
thank you.
Honestly, I hope to one day be as proficient as anything as you are with your gear setup.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. So I think the funny thing, is that I suppose like I am an electronic musician. A lot of the stuff that I make is through MIDI and through my synthesizer and through a computer and everything. But I don't really listen to a lot of electronic music and don't see myself, I guess, as much of an electronic musician. I don't know. This is just like a phase in my life where I'm focusing on doing electronic stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the past, it was more of like experimental stuff or vocal stuff, or I can play a bit of guitar. I grew up playing the drums as well. And so, yeah, I suppose maybe that's why I'm not like a whiz kid with like gear and electronic stuff, maybe, is because, yeah. I don't know. It's hard to explain.
This is like the phase you're in now.
Yeah, I suppose. You know, like growing up, I made a lot of music on my keyboard, which I still have. Actually, it's the keyboard that I use to perform everywhere. It's the keyboard that I grew up with. And so yeah, so like I have a little bit of experience with like programming and layering sounds and stuff like that on my keyboard, just from the stuff that I made growing up, but yeah, not a gearhead. Yeah.
And Late Bloomer came out in 2016, and it's if you bloomed in 2016, are you still blooming?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I'm trying to think of like a good answer for this. Yeah, because like when I made, there's like the cheesy answer of being like, we're always blooming and we're always growing as people, which I do believe.
Sure, yeah.
But I think that like when I made the album, I was definitely fully out and comfortable with being gay. I had been in the gay community for a handful of years. And yeah, so like a lot of the lyrics are about, you know, like relationships and sex and longing for guys that I can never have and stuff like that. And I think that maybe the whole idea of like queerness is actually more new to me than anything, because I've always identified as gay and cisgendered. And I know that that's like within the rainbow, and I do identify with like queer politics and everything like that. And so yeah, like on dating apps and stuff, I put myself down as queer now, and I think that in the last like year or two, I've tried to make efforts to learn about like what does the word queer mean in 2018, you know. And so yeah, like maybe just learning more about like the community, the different people within the community, and about like how I present myself to the world. But maybe that's why I guess I'm still blooming. Mm-hmm. Did that answer make any sense?
That's a great answer. Cheers.
Okay.
Yeah, and speaking of queerness, you're going to be performing at this queer showcase on July 29th.
Yeah, the event is called Pride Tongue Tied, and it is put on through, I guess, CITR?
You bet.
Yeah, and it is starring Kim Mortal, Sorry Edith, myself, in a band that you may have heard of, Miles, Pale Red.
Oh, don't be cheeky. Yes, I've heard of them.
Okay.
They're all right. that's going to be a beautiful show.
Yeah, please come. It is at East Side Flea Market?
I guess East Side Studios, Warehouse.
Yeah.
I don't know if they've settled on like fully on a name yet. It's got a few names, like the new Redgate.
Yeah, I still haven't been to the East Side Studios, so that'll be cool to see the space. Yeah, we'll see. Hopefully people will come. It's part of Queers and Beers.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, and it's all like queer identifying bands involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is awesome.
Yeah, this is great. And I think like queerness is a new thing to me too. Like I came out as queer when I was 25, and I'm 28 now. And it seems very subjective. Like, there's, when I came out, I was kind of, I had been, exclusively with, women until I was 25. Like, that's who I thought I was solely attracted to. It took me until I was 25 to sort of figure out, no, there's definitely a lot more going on with my sexuality than mm-hmm. that. Like, I think when I was growing up, around me, there was, I grew up with quite a lot of, positive, gay influences around me and gay people that I knew and who were very supportive. But, I guess because I wasn't like exclusively gay or exclusively straight, mm-hmm. I didn't really know where I fit in there.
Yeah.
And so queerness to me means that, like, it's just more of an open term. Like, I don't really feel, like I am part of the gay community because, right, yeah. I'm not, exclusively homosexual. So I've always had this sort of weird, like, I'm an in-between person. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, like, when I first moved out of home later on, like, I lived in the city, and I come from this, like, the kind of country-esque
yeah.
little tiny island. So I felt like I was in between the city kids and the country kids.
Okay,
and I didn't
yeah.
feel like a hippie or a redneck. I was somewhere in between those two. Like, there were all these sort of... dichotomies that get set up in your life that make you think, like, oh, I have to choose one or the other.
Absolutely.
And I really couldn't. And I, just, it took me a long time to figure out who I am.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
And I'm still figuring it out.
Yep. Awesome. I feel the same way. Like, I didn't really have any, like, gay role models growing up in Nanaimo at that time. I was very, very in denial about my sexuality for a long time. And it's hard to not be ashamed of that. You know, I think that by at the end of the day, we all need to just, like, own who we are and be proud and out. And yeah, like, I just couldn't do that for, like, a long time. And I spent my 3 years in Montreal just sort of, like, slowly but surely, like, coming out and accepting myself, and didn't do anything with anyone in Montreal, which is, like, a very, very gay friendly city. And so, yeah, like, when I first moved to I was 25 when I moved to Vancouver and came out to my sister a week before I moved here. Mm. And so Vancouver was, like, my big, like, I'm gay experience of, like, meeting people. I didn't know anyone when I moved here. And so that was my community for a few years, was meeting people. And yeah, so I think that I was trying to find some sort of identity, I guess, because I didn't really feel like I fit, like, the gay stereotype, the few that we saw on TV growing up of, like, this the flamboyant, you know, like, pretty boy type guys who are fantastic, but I just didn't feel like I fit that box exactly. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't really have gay people in my life very much that were out growing up. And so, yeah, I sort of discovered the bear community in Montreal, and then was, like, very much a part of that scene, like, an active part of that scene, was going to events and stuff. And so for a handful of years I felt like I was a part of the bear community in Vancouver. Have you heard of the bear scene?
Oh, for sure.
Okay. Yeah. And so after being a part of that community for a few years, I felt, how do I say this, it was a little bit superficial. There are lots of fantastic people in that community. There's definitely pressure to, like, have a beard and to be hairy and to be an exact type of, like, body size and weight. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's kind of like the music scene. It's all kind of superficial. And so, yeah, I was ready to break away from that. I felt a lot of, like, body, like, I was struggling with body image because I always have struggled with body image, and I felt like it wasn't really healthy for me to try to, like, mold myself to like be attractive and fit in with this, like, group of people or this community. And so, yeah, I think that, like, late bloomer for me, and, like, the imagery that went into late bloomer and, like, wearing a dress and stuff, it felt very much like a punk moment in my life. And I do see myself as a punk musician because I just sort of do what I want, don't care about like what is trendy. But yeah, so that was like a big moment for me to break away from my friends and the people in that scene and to just embrace being more feminine and to like, yeah, wear more feminine clothes and to just be like, whatever, that is me. And so yeah, that was like an important like phase of my life that I guess I'm still going through a little bit, but yeah.
I mean, it's hard to like find your scene when you don't, when you're still finding yourself.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
And it, and I guess like I've always, I to some extent I fantasize about the gay scene in Vancouver, like, and the, like the Davie Village, and but I don't go there very often. I haven't been getting involved in it, partly because I find it very intimidating. And
yeah, and honestly, it can be like, I don't want to say anything bad about the scene, but it can be a little bit judgmental towards like bisexual guys or like people who are just identify as queer. You know, like there are a few bars on Davie that are just like very, very gay. It's mostly just like straight up homos. And so yeah, like it's maybe not like the most welcoming like scene to like people who feel like they're in between, but there are lots of people who are very accepting too. I don't want to like discourage anyone from like exploring or just going to bars and stuff.
Oh yeah,
it's, but yeah, it's kind of, yeah, some people are more judgmental and some people are more accepting. It's like anything in life.
Yeah, people are people.
Yeah.
And especially when like a group of people has like come together out of solidarity to support one another, like there needs to be a gay scene.
Oh yeah.
And if you don't identify like strictly as gay, then you know there's usually like, I think at most of these places you can go and be welcomed, but it's a matter of like feeling comfortable.
Yeah.
And I grew up with a lot of internalized shame because I didn't understand that I was queer, and so it's that takes years to really like get over, like to get comfortable and get proud.
Oh yeah, it's taken me, yeah, like I've been out for I guess 8 years now, and a good number of those years was spent, yeah, just like trying to let go of like 25 years of internalized homophobia. Seriously, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes years. Yeah, it takes years.
I feel like I came out 3 years ago roughly, and I feel like I'm a 3-year-old queer, like I'm a baby queer.
Okay. Yeah,
that's how I've been looking at it lately, like just that's what I'm working with. I'm very new to this. I'm learning. I'm still getting on my feet as cool. queer.
I'm glad that you came out. I'm not sure what to say.
Likewise.
Yeah. Yeah, welcome to the,
it's good stuff.
Yeah, I'm glad that we are both under the rainbow.
Great.
There is a place for all of us. I feel like that's an important like message, I guess, not to sound cheesy, but yeah, like there are lots of different people within like the LGBTQ plus community, and some people still don't feel like they fit in to the scene, I guess you could say. But yeah, I really feel like there's a place for everyone.
Yeah,
and like we're all kind of the same in a way.
And some things are cheesy to say, even like, but they're so beautiful. Like it's so true.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind that if people think it's cheesy.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a good place for that stuff.
Cool.